This is Jeff Salzman coming to you from Boulder, Colorado, and welcoming you to this, our third community call for the 2016 Integral Living Room Series. And it's so wonderful to see and feel you all with us here tonight. And I am here, as always, with my comrades in this endeavor, and that is Terry Patton. Say hey, Terry.
Hey, Jeff. Hey, everybody. Delighted to be here from sunny, beautiful Fairfax, California.
And, of course, Diane Musho-Hamilton. Hello, Di.
Hi. Hi, Jeff. Terry. Welcome to the call, everybody. It's great to be on the line. I'm in Salt Lake City, Utah tonight.
Yay. So the call will go on from here for about an hour and a quarter. So we'll end at a quarter after the next hour in your time zone. And this is a prelude to our Integral Living Room gathering. And that will be held this coming November in November 10th through 13th. It's a Thursday night through a Sunday. And I think we have 10 or 11 seats left is all. So I hope you can come if you can, and if not, it's great to have you on the call, and this is a community too, so welcome again. Our topic this year, we do a different topic each year for our conversations that we have at the Integral Living Room, and this year the topic is death and dying, and a cheery topic, but one that's, you know, important to all of us, actually, because we're all mortal. But in the case of this year, made all the more poignant and vivid and immediate with the passing of our dear Brett Walker, who was my assistant for 7 years, and who was a part of the Integral Living Room since day one. He managed the tech and was there at the events themselves. And so we're feeling his immediate loss. He died on the 7th of June, and so whatever that is, 6 weeks ago. And so Brett's here too in some fashion that is mysterious and making it all the more interesting. So before I get off of the weeds here, Di, why don't you sort of give a little more disciplined framing of what it is we're actually doing here?
Yeah, I want to just, I guess just the mention of Brett also brings just bring some tenderness into my heart. Brett studied Zen with me for 7 years, and so we were intimate in a very particular way related to his meditation practice and our practice life together. And I really, you know, having that experience paradoxically brings the issue to life, as we like to say. So it's very, very real and very poignant for me right this moment. Did you want to say anything, Terry, about Brett before I...
Yeah, I just want to say that, that to know Brett was to love him. There wasn't a petty or mean or casual bone in his body. He was a beautiful, beautiful human being. And if there... Among addicts, he was the Buddha of addicts. And, you know, it was tragic that he relapsed and OD'd, but he went through everything, even that horrible ordeal, with a kindness and a sense of beauty and style and generosity that you know, needs to be witnessed and spoken to. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Terry. So last Integral Living Room, at the conclusion of the event, I think we forwarded two or three or four different topics, and the room kind of discussed what they were most interested in exploring. And I think we talked about ethics and about notions of justice in the postmodern mind, and we talked about, you know, sexuality, and we talked about death and dying. And the room kind of overwhelmingly was interested in exploring the topic of death and dying, as Jeff said. You know, each one of us is without exception, going to encounter the moment where we pass from this particular form. And the Integral Living Room has always been driven by this notion that in this context, at least for us, we have the best conversations of our life. We have conversations that seem to be the most wide-ranging in terms of people's ability to speak to, let's say in this case, the dying process, or to talk about grief and loss in relationship to people we've lost, and then our own way in which we've confronted and acknowledged the fact of impermanence in our own lives. And then usually there's a practice component in each of our events where we'll actually do meditations or we'll do practices related to letting go or to surrendering. And so our first call in this inquiry, we spoke with Ken. And Ken, you know, talked very much about working with death in his life and his practice, and also his ability, or one's the need that we each have to contact that which is beyond dying, which is the timeless, unconditioned, true nature of who we are. So as one of the ways that we want to introduce this notion of practice, in other words, can we practice? Can we actually prepare to die? What experiences have we had that would lead us to believe that not only is it possible to prepare, but it's also imperative that we prepare? And I'll back up to what I was saying about Ken in just a moment. But in my own life, my father lost, well, by the time my father was 13, 5 of the 8 people in his life had died. So he lost 3 siblings, his mother and his father. So his lost 2 brothers before he was 10. His mother died when he was 12. His mother died when he was 10. His father died when he was 12. He went to live with his oldest sister. She died having her tonsils out when she was 29. So my dad lost 5 out of 8 members of his family by the time he was 13. And he developed cancer he died now 5.5 years ago, and he was diagnosed with cancer 3 years before he died. And I really couldn't tell whether he had become so accustomed to death that he was so familiar and so at home that he just simply walked through the process, or whether he actually had closed such a tight door on dying at such an early age. And by the time his dying process was over, I concluded it was the latter, that he'd closed a door, and that I felt once it was all, once he had died, that in a certain way, he faced that unknown without preparation. And to some degree, we were unable to join him very fully in his process towards dying because he had closed that door. So for me, preparing to die is a very important part of my meditative and spiritual practice. And so we're concerned tonight with this question about preparing to die. We want to know what you have to say about it. We want to know what your experience has been. You know, have you had near-death experiences? Is it part of your spiritual life? How do you work with this notion of preparation? And so I'm going to return to this topic of what Ken talked about in the first call and turn it over to Jeff to talk about cultivating a relationship to timeless, unconditioned, true nature. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, and this comes from a call that we had early in this process of developing the death and dying living room. And, of course, Ken's part of this, and Ken shows up at the living room. It's really wonderful. And he was telling us that as he was musing about reincarnation, the possibilities of reincarnation, that he brought up a Buddhist teaching that he loved, and Brett and I were both really quite smitten by this teaching. And the teaching was this, that the thing that survives from one lifetime to the next is the sum total of the wisdom and virtue that you created in this life. And I love that because it sort of gives me a project, you know, I have something to do with my spiritual life, and that is to pay attention to that. And wisdom in this formulation is defined as the ability to see emptiness in everything, the ability to realize that all of our ideas of a fixed reality and a fixed identity is shot through with nothing. And that realization itself is liberating. And that realization is available to us really in any moment. And that the more we pay attention to that moment by moment without, you know, necessarily sitting on a cushion or anything other than being in a business meeting and realize, oh my goodness, we're all being lived as well as living. And that softens the whole situation and opens you into a new space. And so Brett and I, you know, we worked with this, and I love that. And now I wonder how it's going for him now. You know, did he get to take that with him? And I assume he did. And it's a good matter of, for me, faith that that happens. And of course, his goodness, virtue is, you know, the good that you do, the love you make is equal to the love you take. That part too. And then I also think with Brett that there was another dimension that is worth noting. I don't know if it's at the same level as your wisdom and virtue, but I think it is, and that's beauty. And Brett was about beauty. He was an Enneagram 4 through and through, tragic, romantic beauty, you know, sensitive and, you know, wanting to be deeply to be seen. And that was, you know, that was very much a part of him. And he surrounded himself with a lot of beautiful items, including this tea set. He was really into tea, kind of like he said, this is my new addiction. You know, when he was clean for many, you know, we were together 7 years, and he was good and clean for six of them. He was obsessed with tea. And so he got this tea set that was made by monks in some far-off monastery in Japan or something, using, you know, ancient techniques. And so you end up with this tea set that is both homely and sort of rough and also extremely delicate and beautiful, but pretty, actually, in a way. And that was, Brett was always really sort of suspicious of pretty, because he was pretty, you know. And he didn't necessarily love that about himself. It made him too easy to love. He wanted to make it harder to love himself. And so I love this tea set. And I knew his mother would love it because he was raised by a mother who loved beauty, and he got that transmitted to him from her. That was his view of it. And so I wrapped it up really carefully and sent it to her and with a little note. And she was very moved and called me. And so now we're getting together. And she's coming out to see Brett's friends and Brett's life out here, and it feels like that it's something that I want to do, it's something that I can do, and that the bigger meaning of it, as I shoot it through with emptiness, as I inhale and include more space, I realize that this is a wonderful, a karmic event for Brett as well. And that he's in on it too. And so that, you know, we can see where there's a certain Brettness that for sure continues, especially as I nurture it, we all do, in our life and realize, what was that piece, what's that piece of my life that I have right now that Brett gave me? And I can see the piece that I got from all kinds of people in my history, and that in many ways the sum total of that. And that opens me up to more space. And then I realized that, you know, I don't rule out that in addition to a Brettness that continues through us and maybe more, that there is ontologically another thing too, and that is Brett. You know, Brett. Maybe Brett continues. You know, and he's still Brett and goes on to, you know, there's wonderful celestial patterns that different religions have that I don't rule out one bit. And so, yeah, I guess I'll just stop there and just appreciate how beautiful it is to work with this. And thank Brett and those of you for listening. Di? Diane? Or Terry?
Yeah,
I'm here.
Speak up.
No, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here.
Thank you, Diane.
I was just feeling what you were saying. So thank you for, I was just touched by the fact that even though Brett isn't here in physical form, that in a subtle way, his impression is continuing, and that in some way your, you know, life is still being informed by him. And So I want to talk just a little bit before I turn it over to Terry. So in the Tibetan tradition, of course, there are many deep yogic practices that relate specifically to not just to relating with impermanence, letting go, moving from this moment to the next moment, and learning how to live within the bardo or a transitional space is a big part of this practice. So there are three bardos in the Tibetan tradition, the bardo of letting go or of dying, the bardo of the open space of the unconditioned mind or awareness, and then the bardo of becoming. And when we think about this dying process, it involves often pain, illness, there could be disappointment if we feel we haven't fulfilled certain things. There could be fear. I know that when a friend of mine died of cancer, she was overwrought with a lot of fear about, she was raised a Catholic as a child and she had lots of nightmares about hell and was afraid she was going to hell, so fear could be part of our experience. And so the art of learning how to surrender to the dissolution or to the discomfort or to the unknown is an enormous part of what it is that we need to learn to work with when we encounter our own dying. And so, Terry, would you mind just maybe taking us through a little bit of your practice related to the art of surrender?
Yeah, thank you. Well, you know, it's often said that all of spiritual practice and meditation are, in a sense, a rehearsal for death, that the letting go that we do in the simplest ways is a rehearsal of a capacity that is tested ultimately in our dying. And the reports that we have from people who have had near-death experiences are that they are released. There is this rushing through a tunnel. There is this sense of a light at the end of this. There are the senses of those who we have loved most in our life, who have predeceased us, you know, greeting us. There is this wonderful quality of release that's ultimately possible, but the process of dying is really gritty, and often there's a lot of pain. Everything that has been the ground of our sense of well-being is breaking up. All is lost, and so there's this potential to surrender into something that we can trust, and yet there's this tremendous, you know, everything in us that can be triggered to think that everything is not okay is going to be triggered. And this process of being with that moment in a way that can open to what might be an excruciating experience, a crushing kind of horrific experience that is sort of terrifying because so much in us is committed to life. It's the most fundamental aspect of our being. Our very heartbeat, you know, is an affirmation. It's a yes to being alive, and to feel that that will stop. It's like I will be taken from everything I love. I will be destroyed. You know, it is going to stimulate every bit of hanging on, every bit of, oh, no, not this, that is there in every bit of my protoplasm. And yet the moment of dying is one I want to go into with a willingness. And so my understanding is that my ability to open, my ability to let go, my ability to simply be with and trust even what doesn't feel at all good is the capacity I'm cultivating so that in that imaginary moment I could go heart first into that tunnel. I could let myself be drawn through all those levels of the cosmos, from the gross into the levels of subtlety, all the way to the unmanifest, with a kind of crazy, excruciating bliss, heart first, surrendering into the mystery, that emptiness that I have cultivated a relationship to, that timelessness is also called God, is also called love, bliss, is also called the radiant, transcendental, conscious heart of existence. I can trust and love and let go into that. And if the doorway is this, you know, horribly difficult process of my own, you know, destruction, my crucifixion, you know, maybe my gasping for breath, maybe my, you know, whatever I'm going through, it is with a trust of that I would hope to be able to engage that quality of surrender. Because, you know, surrender is ultimately a profound, profound pleasure. Anyone who has really, from their heart, bowed down completely and fully, you know, prostrated themselves before that which is sacred, before that which is wonderful, before that which is holy and true and good and beautiful and amazing, has felt relieved. It's in our surrender, in our submission, that we're in right relationship to that which is immeasurably greater than ourselves. And it would be with that attitude that I would hope to die, you know, in my own life experiences, in the moments when I remember one time where there was a really violent turbulence on a flight and I was frightened, and I remember going into a kind of relaxing and breathing and saying, okay, well, if this is it, let it be, you know, let me let go into this. And if it's, you know, and trying to find my way to a depth of my being that would be saying yes to that surrender, even when I might be most sorely tempted to be alarmed and to tighten up and to just go into resistance. And somehow the fact that we would inevitably have some resistance, it's probably, you know, the surrender has to somehow not be a binary thing where we approach death as if we could succeed in our surrender or we could fail, and where we're trying to die a good death, and we're still hanging on in that. That's an ego orientation, and there has to be a kind of radical willingness to be torn to smithereens, because that's really what we're going into. And somehow my ability to bear the ordinary difficulties of my life, my capacity to really let go on the meditation cushion, my willingness to let go into being deeply, deeply there with another human being, you know, all those things are rehearsals for some aspects of this profundity of surrender that I know, in some sense, this whole process of living is a great, multi-colored, amazing rehearsal for. So, yeah. So that's what I can offer. Thank you, Di.
Well, Terry, that was beautiful. I particularly like the pretty parts. The pain and suffering parts I didn't like so much, but. But all in all, very well done.
That's part of the challenge. So I would like to actually lead a little bit of a contemplation. But before we do that, I'd like to hear actually what's coming up for people as they're listening on the call in terms of how do you view or how do you work with preparing to die, and also if you've had any near-death experiences that have changed you. I'd be interested in hearing that, too. So if you have something you'd like to offer, if you press one on your handheld, that would be great. So, George Abero, I guess you say. Go ahead, George.
Okay, thank you. I've read some of the literature on people who have died, and I've read Neil Donald Wallace's whole book detailing what happens after death, and know about but have not read the Eastern Death and Dying. So, and I'm 87 years old, and so I'm pretty close, and have prepared all the legal things, all the things of this life. But my meditation is constantly one of giving up, letting go. And, then I cheat because I know I'm going to get it back when I have to eat breakfast and do the things that are necessary to keep alive during the day, and I do as few of them as possible. Why am I still here? Because I'm perfectly willing and ready to go on and find this next adventure, which I have had some hints about. But the beautiful thing is that in my meditation goes as quickly as possible. It deals with a few things that are going on, but as quickly as possible to a place where there is no thing, nothing, emptiness. And I can be quite comfortable there. And I also encounter an angel from time to time, and people who have already gone before, and we talk a little bit, have met Jesus and whatever. But because of that, that being my connection with those kinds of things. And for others, it would be other people, and that's fine too. I would bless that in them. But so I'm ready. Anytime, and yet I'm still hanging around, seeing if I can do some good in the people in the church where I go and things like that. I have some dementia, so I can start one thing and forget where I am or whatever, but it's interesting.
Well, George, thank you. What I hear from you is that you feel complete in this life. You're 87 years old, and that you work with your meditation practice. And when you meditate, you have subtle realm experiences of angels or of Jesus, perhaps, and that you also are able to empty out and sit in an open space of awareness that's not attached to an object. And then I also hear you say that there are times when you feel relieved because you know you're going to have breakfast. So it's a pleasure to have you on the call, and thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah, and I would just add that he said he hopes he can do some good from time to time, and he did tonight.
Great.
Yeah.
Yes. Wonderful,
right
Jeff. Thank you. Yeah, Terry, go ahead.
Juanita, hi.
Hey.
Hi.
Okay, well, I don't know if this is the time to bring this up, but I think it's interesting that we'll be meeting in Boulder in November, the 160,000 signatures just got turned in today to have a death with dignity law passed in Colorado.
Yes.
And then, yeah, so that's interesting. And my experience, one of them, is in 2014, my husband and I were with his mother when she exercised her right to death with dignity here in Washington State. And when you were talking about meeting death with willingness, she was quoting, right, in the 45 minutes after she took the anti-nausea drug and before she drank the Secanol lethal dose, she was quoting Robert Louis Stevenson's epitaph, which is part of which is, "And gladly I've lived, and glad will I die, and I lay me down with the will."
Mm.
And it was a most amazing 2 week and beautiful experience of someone so happily and cheerfully and eagerly embracing, you know, her death. And yeah, and my husband's laughing because she would have hated this call. This words like meditation, spiritual, subtle realm, she just thought it was all hogwash, but she still lived. She would have hated this phone call. With such a model of embracing death. So I have many other experiences, but for now I just wanted to share that one and thought the timing of this conference with the initiative is very interesting to be holding it in Colorado.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's really, I didn't realize that was going on.
Oh,
what,
yes.
What is that? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we've been living in Colorado, but we just moved back to Washington to be in a state where we did have that option, as my husband's cancer has gotten metastasized and gotten worse. And so
it's
really interesting as living this whole thing and to have choice and to not necessarily wait until the very painful end in when you're in a, if you meet the conditions that the law requires. Mm-hmm. So that would be interesting to discuss later.
Yeah, thank you, Juanita, and I hear your husband in the background, and
yep.
We wish you both well in your journey together.
Yep, yeah, you're smiling our way through it.
Sending love,
hallelujah.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, I didn't realize that. Well, much love.
I would just do, but we'll be in touch.
Great.
All right, so Amy has her hand up. Amy, would you like to make a comment or ask a question?
I'd love to comment. Thank you so much for this call and for this community. I've been living with dying in a really present way for about 16 years now. I have a serious heart and lung condition that has led me to the process of physically dying 3 different times, and I've been blessed to not go all the way, so I'm here with you tonight. And after my first recovery, my first surgery, I knew that I never wanted to leave death, so I immediately became a hospice volunteer, so I've been doing that to stay within that realm. And I've experienced both my own and countless others what are called nearing death experiences. So mm-hmm. those of us who go through long processes of death, which is 90% of us, we have a lot of the same experiences that people report on their near-death occurrences. We go through the same things, but we come back. And after my first return, I used to call it practicing. I was practicing. And so Terry's words that really resonate, that most spiritual traditions revolve around us rehearsing. The more that I experience death, both myself, my own experiences, those people I sit with, and also metaphoric and metaphysical deaths with people I work with through spiritual direction, the more I realize I have no idea anything about it, which is good. I think it's so important for us to practice and to share these stories. And as Terry said, I want to stay away from any way that my mind gets it in rotation that I know what it's like. Because each of my times has been totally different. But what I think is most important for me to share is that for us to spend time together the way we are now, the way we will in November, sharing this vast array of stories and practicing together, that's the most important thing that we can do. So that when, however it comes up for us, that we're a little bit prepared to surrender in whatever way that looks like, without any expectation. Most importantly, to surrender ideas about death.
Hmm.
So yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, right
well,
on.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Amy. Savannah, you raised your hand early on.
Hi, how is everybody?
Yeah.
Nice to hear you all again. This is such an important issue for me. Diane, I wanted to say to you I'm really touched by your story. My mother was close to her death, and she came from a totally different time and perspective on life, which
mm-hmm.
is okay. And I had to respect that that's the way she chose. She didn't do what I wanted, but it would be like. And it was very difficult, very frustrated and helpless feeling. But I really was touched by you sharing that.
Yeah,
and
well,
Terry,
thank you.
To you, I wanted to say that, as you know, I did die. And from what I've seen of modern medicine, when it's my time to go, I'm going to choose to go when I still have my dignity and self-respect. Because I'm not going to go through what they do to people. And my mom and aunt chose to that way, that was their decision, but I'm not doing that.
mm-hmm.
I think if society was a lot more honest about a lot of these issues, there would be a lot less conflict because people understand truth when they hear it. So from my experience, the best I personally can say to you, if it helps at all, is like the Buddha's teaching, it's always now, it's never then.
Very good. Very good.
Thank you,
Savannah.
And
you're welcome. That's right.
I think we have time for one more question or comment, and then I would like to lead us in a meditation. So, Laura, would you like to comment so far?
Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Yes.
You know, I'm quite distraught and confused regarding Brett's death. My teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, assured us that suicide was a bad thing, like a ticket to Vajra hell. And I'm just surprised that the people, you people that surrounded Brett, allowed this thing to happen. I'm not casting blame, but, you know, who can we count on to keep the life spirit alive? Especially since he was a Buddhist practitioner and so forth. Maybe you could comment on that, flesh that out a little bit.
Yeah, I'd be happy to sit with you with your question, Laura, a little bit. So let me make sure I understand what you said. So you said you feel distraught and you feel confused, and that your understanding from Trungpa Rinpoche is that a suicide is a ticket to Vajra hell. In other words, that it's guaranteed that maybe you'll take rebirth in a more difficult situation than the one that you're already in. And I think you're posing a question maybe to me as his Buddhist teacher, why wasn't I able to do more for him, or how could I have allowed that to happen? And I hear you say you're not blaming, but you have a real question about that. Am I hearing you okay?
Yes, that's exactly it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I will say this. It has been a question for me also since Brett died. I think the suicide, people have asked me whether Brett's death was a suicide, and my response has been that when you've had a hardcore addiction like Brett has had, that the blurry line between an overdose and a suicide is sort of in a certain way collapses that clarity. And I would say that for me, I feel that I was extremely present to Brett. He came to my retreat when he was in his first really serious recovery from heroin addiction. And he said to me that, he confessed to me that his deepest wish was to die. And I said to him that in the context of practice, that learning to die on our cushion is really an important thing. And he proceeded to do that. And basically, over the last maybe 2 years or so, his health became really compromised. He was more prone to depression. He really felt the struggle of recovery. But most importantly, he lost his strength physically. And he became really weak in relationship to the opiates. And so we did what I did, what I always did for him, which was I encouraged him and I put him in touch with his recovery people. And he actually was in touch with his counselor the night that he OD'd. And I'm not really sure what more I could have done for Brett. I'm happy to keep asking myself that question. It's very alive for me. Do you have an idea of what you would have liked to see me do?
You know, Di, before you turn to Laura, I want to just, because you've spoken to me about this so, you know, poignantly, I want everyone to know that you have asked these questions of yourself in a very probing way. And it's also true that Brett hid his relapse from all of us as well as he could. And we had some suspicions, but we didn't really know for sure what was going on until the OD happened. And Brett had a superpower of making himself seem okay and kind of diverting people from the level of eye-to-eye confrontation that he perhaps most needed. And I think we all sat in the poignancy of this in a very deep way, and I just didn't want, you know, I wanted to add that to what you had to say, Di, just to do justice. You really have interrogated yourself and learned from this in a beautiful way. I wanted that to be visible, too.
And I shared as well. I mean, I was with Brett day in and day out. I don't believe it was a suicide. Brett was full of plans in life the day he left here. Now, he had the other side, too. He had the depression. But I think he was in that. I agree with Di. It's a sort of a gray zone. That has even some elements of what we're talking about of people consciously deciding that this is enough and I'm going to end it. And we ought not minimize or, you know, just not see the amount of psychic pain that a person can be in. So with that said, I would say that, yes, I feel that I wish I had done more. I wish I had confronted Brett and circled the wagons with him, and I regret that I didn't try harder. And so, yeah, I take that with me, and you know, I have talked to Brett about it posthumous, and yeah, and I won't do that again.
I also want a presence. That's one of the conversations we may find ourselves getting into when we gather in person in November is about these topics, because it is said in many traditions that suicide is a ticket to Vajra hell, but there are people who question that, and there's a legitimacy to ending one's life, perhaps, in very sophisticated and spiritually informed views. And I think being integralists, we can inquire into that question without a rigidity that prevents us from holding all the sides of this really deeply challenging contemplation.
Thanks, Terry. I think that there's, you know, the Jain tradition of fasting to death, where you have a community surrounding you, supporting your decision. I really appreciate all of you for fleshing this out, and I pray for Gret's auspicious rebirth. Thank you.
May it be so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Laura.
Yeah, and I'd like to just also finish what I was about to say, if it's okay with you all, that there is some part of me that I guess I maybe Trungpa and I part the ways in the sense that I actually don't know. And what I do know is that I respect the dignity of each person's very particular path because I don't know and because I spent so much time with Brett around his addiction, and because I also have a brother who's an addict who's never really been able to get clean, that I've also, there's also a part of me that wants to affirm precisely that path and do it with a tremendous amount of humility and an open-heartedness. That there's something innately dignified about every incarnation with all of its conditions. So that part is real for me too.
Thank you, Ty. Yeah, this is a very tender territory. I can feel already the tenderness and depth of the kind of sharing that is wanting to take place. Especially once we're gathering in 3D space together. It's already happening just on this call. Well, Di, you had said you might want to guide us in a process. Does it feel like
yeah.
a moment to do
yeah.
that?
Yeah, I would like to do that. And I also want to just begin by saying that, you know, that the you might say that the yogic architecture of the dying process certainly in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, it's extremely elaborated. And, you know, everything from reflecting on impermanence itself to poa practice and everything in between, that there's a whole range of practices for working with our own dying process. But maybe two of the more important qualities of any practice that we do in relationship to navigating impermanence is first to become simply acquainted and very awake to how much things change, and to become very familiar with the fact that we've all experienced many, many letting goes in this life and many changes of form and many shifts of values and attention, that everything's changing and that we're just simply not who we were before. And the other is what Terry was getting at, which is this this art of learning to relax, of learning to surrender and to be with all dimensions of life, with that which is very disturbing and difficult, like being present to the loss of Brett, being present to not knowing, and learning how to let go and let trust in this process that got us here, you might say. There's a beautiful Rumi poem called The Tavern, and the line that he repeats over and over is that whoever brought me to this tavern, and I'm drunk now and I can't get home on my own, whoever brought me here is going to have to take me home. So there's some trust in this just ability to let go. And then finally, touching in the depending, of course, on your training, but into the open, unconditioned space of who we are that's beyond our relative conditions, beyond our body, beyond our subtle formation, and completely free of personal identity. that to be able to hold space in this open awareness that's beyond our sense of who we are and really let the process carry us are three things that we can really cultivate. So I'd like to begin by asking us to just reflect on the changes that we've experienced. And we'll do this, I'm going to ask you to identify a period in your early life and your midlife and your, you know, your latest life, your most current life. So let's begin. Let's just, if you could, go back to a day. Maybe find a place where you're comfortable. And I always recommend that you find a sitting posture. Bring your attention to the here and now. And if you can feel some stability in your body, and also maybe allow your spine to float upright. Become aware of your breathing without changing it. And allow yourself on the out-breath to feel a quality of relaxation as you exhale. Without manipulating your breath, just simply relaxing with the exhale. And I would like you to choose just a memory, if you would please, sometime before the age of 12. And begin by noticing the physical environment that you were in. What was the landscape like? Or perhaps you're inside of a building or a house. What was the physical environment like at that time? What impressions do you have about the sounds and the smells? Who are the people that surrounded you at that time in your life? Who are the figures that mattered most to you? And can you remember something about your interactions with those people? And maybe some of your emotional experiences at that time of your life. Or even activities that you were engaged in. What is it? How did you spend your time? What interested you? And maybe finally reflect for a moment on how you thought about yourself at that time of your life. What were your concerns? What do you remember about how you treated yourself, for instance? And there are probably different textures, pleasurable sensations in your memory, maybe some that are unpleasant, but just to simply allow them to be. This is one of the most fundamental instructions we have, is to simply be present to whatever it is that arises as part of that gestalt of that memory. Now we're going to notice that your life changed and that the environment probably shifted, perhaps the players, the people changed, the activities. And we're going to let go of this early memory and we're going to move to a new location somewhere in midlife. So again, depending on how old you are, it could be midlife is in your 20s, it could be your 30s, it could be your 50s. So just pick a time and place in midlife and let's visit it and notice what we were surrounded by and what concerned us then. So take a moment to locate a memory from your midlife. And let's begin by just noticing the place you lived. Where were you again? What kind of landscape, city, town, home, apartment? What was the physical environment that you were in? And what were the sense impressions that you experienced at that time in your life? Sounds, smells. Impressions, visual impressions. Take a moment to reflect on the different people. Maybe some were the same, but they may have changed. Maybe they were older, if it's your family or people you were close to, and they're new people, people that weren't there in the first memory. Who are those people? Are there some that are still present? Are there others that came in at that phase and now are no longer part of your life? Who are those people? What were the kinds of activities that you did? What interested you at this midpoint? What consumed your attention? And how did you think about yourself at that time? Who were you to yourself? What were your struggles? What were your ambitions? Were the ways you experienced pleasure? Allow yourself to simply reflect on the impressions that you can still remember from that period. And now let's notice that things have changed very significantly. And we're going to now leave that memory and move into this moment, this here and now moment. And maybe even using your eyes, look around and notice the environment that you're in right now. And what is it that you're surrounded by, your physical environment? Notice the landscape or the housing or the situation that you're in right now and just take in some of the detail. And who are the people who are most vivid in your life today? Maybe just the three or four, maybe five people that you really spend most of your time with. And if you've been with them a long time, notice how they've changed. And there may be some that are newer, that weren't in those last two memories. Who are those people? Could be a new baby. Maybe animals, too, that have come and gone. are the animals in your life right now? And what activities do you find yourself in currently? How are they different maybe than what you were doing in those other two memories? And what is your relationship to yourself? What are your thoughts and your concerns? Maybe some of your struggles? And how are they different at this life stage than before? There may be something, if nothing else, what we notice that's continuous, what's been with you from the very beginning, through your early life, through your middle years, whatever, right now, the one thing you can notice that many of the objects of your life have changed. Your body has changed, certainly. People have grown, changed, come, disappeared. You've experienced so many things. But the one thing that's been consistent all the way through is your awareness. You have been aware and cognizant at every moment in your life. So for a moment before we end, I'd like you just to simply notice awareness itself. What is this marvel of conscious perception? What is this ability we have to perceive that is completely and utterly available at every moment and receives whatever changes there are? And let's just let ourselves sit for a moment with this open, unconditioned awareness. And when all the objects in our life in this moment change again, but this awareness will still be here. Resting our attention in this open space. Clear, immediate, without judgments of good or bad. Simply reflecting what is. And then we say, like an empty mirror. Thank you, everyone, for engaging us with this reflection on change and impermanence. Jeff, Terry, thank you.
Thank you, Di.
Thank you, Di. That was just beautiful.
we have just a few minutes on the call. If you have a comment or a question, if you'd like to press one on your handheld, we have some space to hear from you.
Bob Schoeniger had raised his hand earlier. Would you still like to speak, Bob?
Do you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I think that probably what I had to say then was probably a little longer than just a brief comment, so I'll pass till the next time.
All right. Thank you, Bob. Jason. Whoops. Losing you here. Where are you?
Hey, Bob, it's Diane. Is there some kernel of what you wanted to say that might be, that you could offer in this moment?
The console has already closed him off.
Okay, sorry about that.
I do see that my friend Marge has raised her hand. Hi, Marge.
Hi, Terry, and thank you so much, Di. That was utterly beautiful. It took me on a life journey. The first journey was the death of my father when I was 11. The second one was the death of my mother when I was in my 40s. The third one was the death of a beloved in my life that was just 5 years ago, and also the death of my son. And your guidance was simply exquisite. The different levels of consciousness and awareness and understanding were so present. And most of all, I loved when you took us into awareness of awareness, which I've come to understand through working with Terry, and Terry O'Fallon. So profoundly beautiful, that capital A awareness of the small case A awareness, and how significantly it changes who we are and the vastness of what we perceive. And I know for myself that when I approach that moment, it will not be with fear, it will be with welcoming. And actually, there is a part of me with understanding of multiple realities existing simultaneously that is so looking forward to once more being with the beloveds in my life. So your meditation was a great, great gift. And thank you.
Thank you.
What a beautiful response, Marge. Thank you.
Do we have time for one more? Yeah, I think so.
I had seen Jason's name and then lost track of him, and here he is. Hi, Jason.
Hey, how's it going? I just was curious. All three of you have been around the spiritual scene for quite a while. Have you ever actually known someone that was able to have, like, first-hand experience of going through the Bardo realms or remembering a past life? Or is it pretty much just tradition and hearsay? Or secondhand, like someone knows someone that knows someone that went through that?
It's very rare. And the people I know who have reported those experiences are only a very few. But yes, I know some people who I find credible who do report direct experience of those realms. And my own experiences are more limited. The real passing through those experiences is pretty rare. Pretty high practitioners are able to do it. It's out of the range of most people's experience, in my experience. What about you guys?
Well, this is Diane, Jason. So in terms of your question, I would say not literally, but one of the things about the Tibetan Book of the Dead and working with Bardo spaces is that we start to see that these kinds of experiences are also happening in life, and that we're making transitions constantly into new ways of being and new forms, and that there's often a letting go that's very challenging and an impulse to grasp or to hold on, and then a moment where we have to relax and allow life to carry us and change us. So in one way, I feel very familiar with the Bardo realms in terms of my own life. But I will share just one story with you that kind of comes from my practice, and that is, I talked a little bit earlier about the death of my father. When my father died, I was very close to him, and I was also very close to him during his dying process. And so it was very natural for me he died kind of later in the evening, and so our household quieted down relatively soon, and we all went to bed. And so for me, it seemed appropriate to simply meditate. And I quieted my mind, and even in terms of reflecting on my father, at a certain point I stopped doing that, and I just sat in the way that I've been trained to do for a long time. And as I was sitting, within my field of awareness emerged or appeared a kind of luminous orb, you might say. Just as I was sitting, this luminous orb appeared, and my thinking mind said to myself, well, this is kind of funny, like there's this quality of light, a light orb that I'd never experienced before. But I thought, all right, I'm not going to doubt it too much, so I'm just going to put my attention in this light and affirm it. And I did. And as I did, I had the most amazing experience of relaxation move through my body from my head all the way through I've never been so infused with love and so relaxed as I was at that moment. And the next night I had the exact same experience. I had the same experience in my meditation. So I really loved what Amy said earlier, that she's been working with dying for over 16 years, and what she's come to is that she doesn't really know, and that what's most important is to learn to surrender and also to relax with not knowing, but being present to what really does arise. So that's what I'd like to share with you, Jason.
Thank you very much.
Yep, you're welcome.
And I would just quickly share that the best I can do is experience from doing psychedelics, where I face all sorts of monsters and just hideous states. And what I've learned over the years, not that I am a great psychedelic practitioner, but I've, you know, had my dozen or 20 experiences, that there's no state that I can't have awareness of. And that when I have an awareness of a state that is on the, you know, hell side of the street, that I can, at this point, reliably surrender myself to it, sometimes feed myself to the monster, turn towards it, whatever, but metabolize it in real time to love and wisdom. And so I'm sort of counting on that and hoping that, you know, I get to take that with me. But we'll see. So I think this is the time to end our call. And Di or Tara, anything further to say?
I just want to thank everybody thank you guys especially. You know, this has been a very beautiful and deep conversation, and the quality of the comments and shares has really touched my heart. I'm getting really excited about what it's going to be like to gather together in Boulder in November.
Yeah, me too. Di?
Yes. I just want to thank everybody. Thank you for being here. Bye, everybody.
Bye, folks.